Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. Father Ron Langman, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. As we do each week, as a way of introducing the topic for the night, I'd like to begin with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. Jesus was pleased that many people wanted to question him. A man named Joseph came to Jesus and said, "Master, I admire your great insight, but what concerns me is that there seems to be a division in the human race." "What do you mean?" Jesus asked. "There is good and there is evil," Joseph answered. Jesus nodded in agreement, and Joseph continued, "I worry a lot, Master, because man seems so intent in expressing his own views that many times they turn to anger instead of love and understanding. He sees only his side of the argument and not his brother's." Then Joseph looked down and said, "Master, we are an oppressed people. Many do not like us, even though we do them no harm. Why? Why can't there be peace? Why must there be hatred and anger? Even among our own people there is division." Jesus nodded and said, "To attain peace, one must first have peace of heart. He must understand himself if he is to understand others. If he is kind, kindness will be shown to him. If he is generous, his rewards will be many." Joseph shook his head and said, "Master, I have tried to be understanding, kind, and caring. But many times I am hurt, ignored, and yes, even abused in the process." Jesus put his arms around Joseph and said, "My friend, keep your heart pure and loving. When your enemy is cruel to you, do not return cruelty, but show him where he is wrong." Peter, who was taking all this in, said, "Master, that's easy for you to say." A slight smile appeared on Jesus' face, and then tears began to form in his eyes as he said, "My time will come, Peter, my time will come. Let us come together as brothers and pray. Pray that there will be peace upon this earth. For when my Father created it, he created it so that it would be a place of love, not a world of hatred, deceit, or pain." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in the beginning of the introduction to his latest book titled Last Call for Liberty, How America's Genius for Freedom Has Become Its Greatest Threat. He writes, "With America bitterly divided, in American public life sinking into chaos and conflict, may a visiting foreigner be permitted a word? For admirers of America today, sleep has become fitful. The great American Republic is in the throes of its gravest crisis since the Civil War, a crisis that threatens its greatness, its freedom, and its character. As with that earlier time of terrible self-inflicted judgment, the deep threat is not the foreign invader, but the American insider. The problem is not America against the world or the world against America, but America against itself. Citizens against citizens, government against citizens, one president against another president, and one view of America in radical opposition to another. Americans have become their own most bitter enemies, and even the enemies of their centuries-old republic. The stock market may soar for the moment, the big box stores may be packed during sales, and the sports and entertainment machines may hum with their daily headlines. But no one should be deceived. Radical, violent, and anti-democratic movements are being fomented and funded on both the left and the right. The left sees only the danger of the right, and the right the danger of the left. No So extremism confirms and compounds extremism. Political debate has degenerated into degrading and barbaric incivility and wild talk of spying, leaking, impeachment, governability, the 25th Amendment, and even assassination and succession is in the air. American leaders and opinion leaders are at each other's throats, intent on tearing each other apart. Careless with their insults and their incitements, many Americans are seething with rage over other Americans. America is locked in a mortal struggle for what each side believes is the soul of the Republic. Heedless of the consequences, each side thinks the worst of the other. The once visionary leadership of the free world has ground to an inglorious halt, and the suddenness of America's decline is shocking as well as tragic to its admirers. Our guest this evening is Os Guinness. He was born in China, educated in England. He is the author of more than 30 books, some of which we've discussed on this program over the years, and why I'm always eager to have him back as a guest. He has a doctorate degree in philosophy from Oxford, has been a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a fellow, senior fellow, at the East-West Institute. He is a frequent speaker and a prominent social critic. He has addressed audiences worldwide, a passionate advocate of freedom of religion and conscience for people of all faith and none. So that's how he fits in this particular program. He was the lead drafter for both the Williamsburg Charter and the Global Charter of Conscience. He believes now that no one knows the outcome for America. He makes no predictions, but calls for a decisive choice for a renewal of freedom. And this book, Last Call for Liberty, is an expression of freedom. He believes that America must make clear what it means now by freedom, that our society verges on madness and self-destruction. And I have to ask you, welcome, first of all, Dr. Guinness, to our program once again. But I want to ask you, I don't know how long ago you write this book. Usually it takes a year or more. Is this book still an accurate view of what you have written, that what we are seeing is not politics as usual, but political warfare in a dangerously radical style led by leaders who should know better?
Well, thank you. First of all, it's a great delight to be back on your program. And as for the book, yes, I think it is up to date. If you take something like the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, which happened after the book went to the publisher, I think they illustrate very well the same problem.
And you write, it's your belief that the United States is weaker now than it has been since the beginning of World War II. That's quite a statement.
Internationally, I was saying, yes. Yeah, well, my argument is, as you know from later pages, that America is as deeply divided as at any time since just before the Civil War. But, of course, the question is, why?
Yes.
Now, many people would say it's just another episode of left against right, or people say it's the coastals in California and New York against the heartlanders in the Midwest, or it's the nationalists and populists over against the George Soros-style globalists. And I think all of those have something to say to it, but the deepest problem of all, as I analyze it, is that you have those who understand the American Republic and above all, freedom at its very heart, through the lens of the American Revolution, 1776, which, of course, was decisively Christian and biblical. Not completely, but mostly. And those, on the other hand, who understand the Republic and freedom through the lens of 1789, the French Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and many years since then, such as Friedrich Nietzsche and Antonio Gramsci and in America, Herbert Marcuse in the 1960s, and more recently, Michel Foucault. And you can see two very different views of America and two very different views of freedom. And I think that's the deepest division. So just as Lincoln said before the Civil War, America cannot continue half slave, half free. So I would argue today, America cannot continue half 1776 and half 1789, as it were.
And you point out that it was the Russian and Chinese revolutions who adopted the understanding of freedom as expressed in 1789 in the French Revolution and not in the American in 1776.
No, that's right. And you have two revolutions, the English, which was only half successful and eventually failed, and the American, which was gloriously successful, which were decisively biblical in their roots, and all sorts of things follow from that. For example, you have a realistic view of human nature, because sin is at the heart of human nature, so the separation of powers, checks and balances, and so on. So you have a very, very different view from the other three revolutions, the French, the Russian, and the Chinese, which were all essentially utopian. You know, as Rousseau said, man is born free, but everywhere is in chains. So you just remove the chains or oppression here, or oppression there, and then, as one writer puts it, people will be happy, free, and fulfilled. But of course, they weren't, and that sort of freedom led to a reign of terror in each revolution, and also, sadly, the killing fields. And 2 million may have been killed in the French Revolution, 25 or 30 million in the Russian Revolution, and some historians say maybe up to 60 or 75 million in the Chinese Revolution. So they have very different views of freedom, and they come out in very different areas.
Certainly freedom, you point out, has always been the key to America, that our view of freedom is now at the root of the problem, and that the freedom is one of the deepest and almost universal desires of humanity. Tell us a little bit about why you believe there is a vacuum of leadership at our highest levels.
Well, first, the point you make, you drew out right then. I mean, follow St. Augustine, who argues, put it in modern terms, you don't judge a nation by the size of its population or the throw weight of its missiles or the, you know, the numbers surrounding its GNP and so on. You look at what St. Augustine calls what it loves supremely. And I don't think there's any doubt that what America loves supremely from the beginning right down till now is freedom. And when Americans call themselves the land of the free, and many, many people have said variations on that, that's what America loves supremely. That's why a division over freedom is so fundamentally important, which it wouldn't be to many other countries. So that's worth underscoring. Mm-hmm. Freedom is the great issue for Americans.
And you indicate in your book, The Last Call for Liberty, and if anyone's interested in the United States and what's going on now and where we're moving in the future, you really need to get a copy of this book, How America's Genius for Freedom has Become Its Greatest Threat. But you write, there are three kinds of issues in America's challenge today. The elementary issue of what freedom means, the ultimate issue of how it is to be sustained, and the practical issue of how it can be restored when it has been nearly lost. And you write that all three issues are raised by the confusion and clash over the definition of freedom that underlies many of today's conflicts in American public life. How then did we get to this position?
Well, I think you can see many reasons why the framers and the founding principles of America have been decisively rejected in many of our elite institutions. Now, the problem is that while the Declaration promised liberty and justice for all, the Constitution didn't deliver it for all. And you can think of, say, the Three-Fifths Clause, and you can think of slavery. In other words, at the heart of the Constitution, despite the Declaration, there was an evil, a hypocrisy, and a blatant contradiction. Now, Lincoln and many others addressed that. Lincoln appealed to the Declaration, tackling the evil of slavery, and called, he addressed what he called the better angel of the American nature. And you can see the same thing, say, in Dr. Martin Luther King. He appealed to what he called the promissory note of the Declaration. In other words, the Declaration promised liberty, but it didn't cash it in. So times had come, the civil rights movement, to cash it in. But then as you move from Martin Luther King to Stokely Carmichael, and all the general ideas of the 60s, which flow from people like Kransky and Marcuse, whom I mentioned, you can see that somewhere around 1968, there was a fateful lurch left. And America was then seen as chronically racist, sexist, militarist, hegemonic, and you name it. And since then, there has been a repudiation for the founders. It's not just they were wrong here, but they were right there. The baby, bathwater, and all has been thrown out. Take, say, the kneeling controversy in the NFL. You know, Martin Luther King appealed to the Declaration, the promissory note. But the kneeling controversy, they're actually disrespecting the anthem, the flag, and the Declaration itself. And you wonder, do they realize what they're doing? Very different from Dr. King. Are they appealing without realizing it, or some do realize it, to a very different revolution than the American Revolution? So you can see, and take, say, the fact that 50 years ago this year, this is 2018, 50 years ago, 68, a very crucial year in the development of the 60s, Rudy Deutschke called for a long march through the institutions. And you can see how these ideas have won the day in the colleges and universities, in the press and the media, and in the world of entertainment, including Hollywood. And those areas today, in many ways, are decisively against the founding fathers and dismiss them in one way or another. So these ideas have come in, and America's deeply divided. And the great difference from just before the Civil War, there's no Lincoln.
Right.
In other words, there's no leader with a sense of the brilliance of the Declaration and a sense of history who can tackle the worst and appeal to the best. And that's what I think is missing today. So you say the president's Make America Great Again. Well, that to him is largely the economy and the military. And that wasn't what made America great. So the real question is, what made America great in the first place?
Can we stop?
America great again?
Let's stop. We need to take this break, and let's pick up with that question when we come back. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest is Dr. Os Guinness. We're talking about his book, Last Call for Liberty. You've not heard me say this for a long time. This is going to be one of the books I put on my special shelf, book that I'm going to read again, and going to read it more than once and going to be able to refer back to it. Let me just say something about it. The introduction is 17 pages, and I think I could spend the whole program talking about the introduction so that you have a good foundation for what follows in the rest of the book, but I don't really want to do that. Dr. Guinness himself explains that his approach is simple and forward, that he wants to set out a checklist of 10 questions that are essential for assessing the character and health of freedom in the United States and the requirements for its restoration and renewal. And we have some difficult decisions to make in the future. And he points out that the task is great and the hour is late. I cut you off a little bit when we went to the break. Is there more that you wanted to say? You had posed the question that we need to be thinking about what it is that made America great.
In the first place, that's right. And I think there's no question that it's a matter of freedom. As you say, the book is a checklist of 10 questions. I wrote an earlier book, I think you had me on, called A Free People's Suicide, which is on the problem of sustainable freedom. But in the debate that followed that, I realized that a lot of Americans never really asked what actually is freedom. Now, you remember the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln said, everyone talks of freedom, but the North means one thing and the South means something quite different. So we have to define what we really mean by it. And you can see today the tremendous differences over the way all Americans say freedom and, you know, the positive F words, faith, family, freedom, they sort of roll off the tongue for many people, but they never stop to ask what actually it means. And yet those differences are becoming incredibly important today.
Question one, do you know where your freedom came from? Tell us a little bit about the great gift of the Jews as recounted in the story of the Passover. You point out that it is a template for society, for human personhood, freedom, justice, and social justice that shaped the American Revolution in highly practical ways and contributed even to the U.S. Constitution and the notion of constitutionalism.
Well, many Americans don't actually realize that. You know, if you ask Americans where did freedom come from, you know, 50 years ago they would have said it was the, quote, ancient liberties of the English, things that were behind the New England Puritans and so on. And that's true, but that's been rejected with the rejection of everything WASP and now the rejection of white privilege and so on. So most Americans would say freedom must have come from Athens and the Athenian notion of democracy. Well, as you know well, Father, it didn't last more than 50 years in Athens, and the framers were very wary of Athenian democracy. And the fact is, historically, it didn't come from Athens. It came from Mount Sinai. And you can see the Reformation went back to the book of Exodus, and essentially, Exodus is the master story of Western freedom. And above all, not just freedom itself, but the notion of covenants, because that's behind Constitution and the understanding of ordered liberty, which is the genius of this country. And if you look at some of the distinctive features of the Jewish covenants, freely chosen consent. Mm-hmm. It's the first use of the consent of the governed. People don't realize that. Then you had a morally binding pledge. And you also had the third great element, the reciprocal responsibility of everyone for everyone. Every Jew responsible for every Jew. In other words, you're in the middle of a view of society where relationships and responsibility are at the core of things. And you can see that's very different from democracy. Democracy has zero social content, just says who's supposed to rule. And in the day of the internet and many other things, that's rather a dubious notion, or increasingly so. But covenantalism, the idea at the heart of everything, are relationships, that love your neighbor as yourself, the love of the stranger, because you were strangers once, and so on. You have in covenantalism a very, very different view.
And one of the points that you make there is that for the Jews at Sinai, the covenant was, quote-unquote, with God, close-quote. And for most of American history, the covenant was genuinely under God, but now it has become a constitution without God, and that Americans will have to pay today if they reject God as the final standard of accountability. Do you see that happening? You see the beginnings of that?
Oh, very much so. I would argue that under God, it just sounds like a trite word to many people today, but it was the final check and balance. In other words, you have a moral limit to power, and that's incredibly important, because if a state is the final arbiter, then the state sets the tone for everything, and the state, you know, is in control of violence, as they put it. But if you have a moral limit to power, everything's under God, and authority is delegated, you have a very, very different view of responsibility of governments and leaders and officials and so on. So that was once a very real thing that meant accountability. But sadly, it's gone, and even the phrase is attacked today by people like Michael Newdow and the ACLU.
You write that the challenge for Americans today, while they are still powerful and prosperous, is to remember the long road to freedom they have traveled and to pay attention to the lessons while there is time for renewal. Where do we find those lessons? In a book like yours, right?
But well, if you think, as historians say, if you take the whole history of civilization and pack it into 1 hour, free societies probably only enter in the last 5 minutes. They're rare, they're fleeting. And we should have a realistic sense they're not easy. Freedom is never easy. So we've got to ask, how do you sustain them? How do you guard them? Whereas people today think, we're free, we'll always be free. And the naivety of that is quite appalling. particularly at a time when there are so many views of freedom that are disastrous and undermining genuine freedom. So we need something of the realism of history. One of my checklists is, how do we face up to the paradox of freedom?
Yes.
The idea that freedom is its own worst enemy. The greatest enemy of freedom is freedom. And a lot of people don't understand that, and so they fall foul of the paradox, I'm afraid.
Question two is, are there enough Americans who care about freedom? Tell us a little bit about what Rabbi Abraham Heschel meant by the phrase escape to suspicion.
Well, he was talking about the early stages of postmodernism, where you see behind everything. Nothing has taken a face value. There's no smoke without a smoke machine. And so you breed people who are cynical, people who are suspicious of everything. So in the end of the day, you undermine simple, straightforward convictions, and above all, trust. And trust is the bonding that's absolutely essential in any society. How does trust come? Well, every day we all make all sorts of intentions and promises about the future. See you for lunch tomorrow. Well, let's meet at 11.
Yes.
You know, if I say things like that and don't turn up, I'm up there for lunch and I arrive at 2 o'clock, not 11, I would not be predictable, trustworthy. And you can see that promise-keeping, in other words, our statements about the future, the big ones are marriage and things like that, but I mean even down to little small ones. Out of promise-keeping comes trustworthiness and predictability and trust in families, in businesses, in communities, and in the country as a whole. As postmodernism, you suspect everything. We read conspiracy theories. We trust no one and so on. Well, it undermines freedom very powerfully.
And, of course, there are always many challenges to freedom the way which we understand it becomes the real threat. And you write about open-endedness and conditionality are a constant challenge for freedom, and no generation can claim immunity. And you write, this means that there are always two moments of special danger for freedom. The first is when any generation is tempted to think it unfair that their ancestors committed them to the arduous task of sustaining freedom. And the second and obvious danger is when freedom grows complacent, when a free people settle down or are tempted to believe that freedom has arrived and is now assured. And it just isn't sustained that way, is it?
No, that's right. Another way of putting that is, as Rabbi Heschel put it, you know, if you live under a dictatorship, you have no responsibility at all, except for your own safety. You want to keep out of the surveillance and so on. But you have no responsibility at all. The big leader, the tyrant, he's in charge, he's responsible. But in a republic, in a democracy, we're all responsible. And that's the challenge. A lot of people don't want to face up to that. And times of prosperity and power, and therefore complacency, are the worst. And you can go right back to the classics. You know, if you go back to Cicero and Polybius and Greek and Roman classics, that's what they say. At times of power and prosperity, there's what they call a corruption of customs. People lose their convictions in the great beliefs that make the difference to freedom. And that always happens in times of power and prosperity. And you can see that's happened, you know, in the 60s and in the 80s in this country. You take, say, the so-called unipolar moment. Soviet Union collapsed. America was unprecedented, unrivaled, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it bred a complacency that was absolutely foolish. And here we are, not many years later, and you can see we're in a multipolar world where China's rivaling America, and many of the countries in the world are just uneasy with American leadership and openly rejecting it. So you've got to be especially aware in times of power and prosperity because they breed complacency, and freedom always has to be vigilant, never complacent.
Another concern of yours is that freedom talk is cheap in America today, and you write it often has the tones of complacency, self-congratulation, and with marketers, marketing, and politicians running for office, self-promotion. This is not unexpected in an age drunk with its own heady cocktail of individualism, libertarianism, consumerism, and narcissism, when it's all about us and I, my selfie, and me. And you point out that that we were a designer nation, the first new nation, at least in the modern world. And the same was true of the Jewish people, which we've talked about through the covenant, as they were constituted by their covenant at Mount Sinai. You've written this book as an expression of hope. What is that hope, finally, that you would want to try to have us think about and work for into the future?
Well, I write the book, and from beginning to end, as you put it, I'm an admirer of this country. I mean, American freedom is probably the longest running part of political freedom in history. That's amazing. In other words, what happens now is important not just for Americans, so you can continue to be free, but it's important for the world. Can freedom be sustained, you know, over the decades and the centuries? That's the great question. So for me, it matters for the world whether Americans come out rightly or wrongly. Now, the great thing about covenantal freedom is that, on the one hand, covenants can be broken. God keeps his word. We humans often don't. But while that's true, that doesn't lead to pessimism, because covenants can be restored. And that's what Lincoln was doing. You remember, he talked in the Gettysburg Address about a new birth of freedom. The country was conceived in liberty, but it needed a new birth of freedom. In other words, renewal of the American dream, the American covenant, and so on. And I believe today we need a new birth of freedom. So believing that, I call for a leader who will be like Lincoln and call the nation back to its roots and to the best of its past, the better angels, and so on. So I'm a great believer in the possibility of renewal, and that's why I hope my book, which is pretty realistic, will also be seen as a beacon of hope.
The third question is, what do you mean by freedom? We've been talking a little bit about that, and you present some concepts of what freedom is. First, freedom is a matter of the human will. Second, freedom entails the idea of commitment, making and keeping a promise. Third, freedom includes the notion of human responsibility. Freedom means deciding between choices and acting on our choices. And freedom then means that, precisely, you write, because we are free, we are responsible, whether we like it or not. Conversely, we would cease to be free if we were not responsible. And so freedom and responsibility are inseparable, you write, at the heart of growing into adult life and citizenship. The fourth, freedom is a matter of power. In a sense, you write, it can be said that freedom empowers just as power frees. If power is defined as the capacity to exert the will despite resistance, then power is essential to freedom. Fifth, freedom is not only a matter of choice, but of having genuine options from which to choose. The sixth, freedom itself is not an end, but a means to a goal. And seventh and last, freedom has a social and collective dimension. It is not purely individual. It requires foundations in the sense of the philosophical and ethical underpinnings that can ground freedom as genuine and secure. Pick one or two of those for us. Or pick one. We're up against, we have like 3 minutes before we take the next break. Select one of them. And
let me pick up some of the distinctions, Father, that come out of that. Because one of them is the great distinction your own great Catholic layman, Lord Acton, emphasized, that freedom is not the permission to do as we please, what we like. Freedom is the power to do what we ought. In other words, freedom requires truth. Remember Jesus saying, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Freedom requires truth, character, and a way of life. And that's against the sort of libertarian view of today. Just do what you like, so long as you don't harm anyone else, and so long as you do it consenting with anyone else. You know, but that sort of freedom simply won't last. Another great distinction, I remember this when I was at Oxford, came from Isaiah Berlin, the great Jewish philosopher, who made the difference between negative freedom and positive freedom. Negative freedom is freedom from. No one's free if they're under the control or coercion of anyone, a bully, a sex predator, or a colonial power, or they're under the control of anything, such as drugs or pornography or alcohol. We need negative freedom, freedom from. That's the beginning of freedom. And, of course, for us as Christians, the fundamental freedom is a freedom from sin and death. But that's only half of it. The other half is positive freedom, freedom for, freedom to be. And most American freedom, sadly, is only the first. You know, liberals want to be free from the government over their bodies. Conservatives, free from the government over their bank balances and so on. But that's only half of freedom. And if you look in the book of Exodus, as the rabbis say, it took the Lord one day to get Israel out of Egypt. Yes. But it took him 40 years and more to get Egypt out of Israel. In other words, liberation is only the beginning of liberty. Liberty is far more than liberation. And we need to understand that liberty, it takes time, it takes work, it takes training, it takes mastery. It's much more like piano playing or ballet dancing or a skill or an art. As Tocqueville said, the apprenticeship of liberty is arduous.
Let me read us out to our next break with the words of Rabbi Abraham Heschel. Freedom is not an empty concept. Man is free to be free. He is not free in choosing to be a slave. He is free in doing good. He is not free in doing evil. To choose evil is to fail to be free. In choosing evil, he is not free, but determined by forces which are extraneous to the spirit. Free is he who has decided to act in agreement with the spirit that goes beyond all necessities. We're going to take this break, and then we'll be back to continue our discussion with Dr. Os Guinness about his book, Last Call for Liberty. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest this evening is Dr. Os Guinness. We're talking about his latest book, Last Call for Liberty. We're reflecting on the 10 questions that he raises within the book. He has a hope for the book. I have a hope for this program, and that would be that each of us can, that we can touch on, at least touch on the 10 questions. I want you to get a feel for the book, because I really want you to consider getting a copy of the book, and there's so much more to be learned about the issue we are facing, perhaps the crisis that we are facing. The first questions we dealt with are, do you know where your freedom came from? Are there enough Americans who care about freedom? Third question is, what do you mean by freedom? And to close that discussion up, he points out that as Americans choose their freedom and make their beds, so they will lie in them. And there will, of course, be consequences whether they are conscious of their choices or not. He believes it's time for Americans, from each successive president to the youngest schoolchild, to explore what they mean by freedom and to know whether they have thought through the outcome of the kinds of freedom they are pursuing. And you're really calling for education that's been lost in our system, aren't you, the Constitution and our government and the whole concept of freedom?
Oh, absolutely. I'm constantly calling, on the one hand, leadership. I mentioned Lincoln-like leadership. But the other constant call is for a restoration of civic education. I mean, you take your early American motto, a pluribus unum, which even the European Union now has its own version of. In other words, out of many, one. If that collapses and it's been thrown out, or civic education has been thrown out since the late 60s and the early 70s in public schools, there's no melting pot, there's no unum, America will be shaped more by immigration than it will be by the revolution. And it'll be another factor undermining the American Revolution. So freedom is to survive. You need the structures of freedom, the law, the constitution, regulations, things like that. But you've got to have the spirit of freedom, as habits of the heart, as Tocqueville called it. And that can only be kept alive through civic education. You know, the Jews point out, going back to Exodus, what did Moses speak about the night of the Passover? Hundreds of years of slavery. Tonight we're going free. Does he talk about freedom? No. Does he talk about the promised land of milk and honey? No. Mm-hmm. Does he talk about the dangers of the howling wilderness they've got to cross? No. He talks three times about children, children, children. In other words, the Jews understood that both for faith and for freedom, schooling is more important than an army. Now, sadly, America's abandoned civic education, and that's an absolute disaster.
Mm. Let's go to the next question. Question four: have you faced up to the central paradox, freedom? And you touched on in the first hour that indeed freedom is the greatest enemy of freedom, and you point out that only by facing up to the paradox of freedom can Americans survive and thrive as a free people in true freedom. And you speak about there are three major reasons why freedom has proved to be the greatest enemy of freedom. There must be foundational faith that grounds and guarantees that we are indeed free. Second, there must be the respect that is prepared to grant similar freedom for others. And third, there must be the responsible self-restraint that issues from self-role or mastery of the self. And so freedom is not just about me, is it?
No, certainly not. You think how easily freedom undermines itself. Freedom becomes permissiveness, becomes license, and then anarchy, and swings to the opposite, authoritarianism. Oh, freedom-loving people so love safety and security that they surround themselves with all sorts of things that undermine freedom. One nation under surveillance. And if you go on down the line, and then you look at the reasons this is so, and freedom requires restraint. Edmund Burke says we've got to have a chain on our appetites. It's not doing whatever you like. But the only restraint that's really appropriate to freedom is self-restraint. But of course, yes, self-restraint is what freedom often undermines when it flourishes and it becomes licensed to do whatever you like and becomes self-undermining again. So we've got to have a living sense of the challenges of freedom and how we've got to be vigilant and very careful, or otherwise it will undermine itself all over again.
And to get back to those three major reasons why freedom has proved to be the greatest enemy of freedom, the first reason is political. The second reason for the paradox is ethical. And the third reason for the paradox is spiritual and psychological. Say something about the spiritual and psychological for us.
Well, freedom requires responsibility. But as the Jews point out from the very beginning of Genesis, after the fall, the refusal, the evasion, the abdication of responsibility is at the heart of the human inclination. Christians would call it sin. So you get to a situation where people, rather than being responsible, they even find tyranny having a certain freedom, because people are dependent on the strong man or the government and what they're entitled to and so on. And you can see that happened in Germany before the war. And you can see that happening in many parts of the country today. Americans have lost that responsibility of self-reliance. And they increasingly claim entitlements for this and that, which means they're dependent on others to do for them what they should really be doing for themselves. A self-governed people who are really free are self-reliant and responsible. That gets undermined, and that's what I mean by the spiritual and psychological way people even find in tyranny of freedom and a tyranny in freedom, which is a real paradox.
And you point out that liberty is deeper and more difficult than liberation, that personal and social transformation takes longer than revolution, and self-reliant responsibility is far harder than easygoing entitlement. And then I like this, with their characteristic candor, you write, the Jewish sages noted wryly that it took one day to take the Israelites out of Egypt, but 40 years and counting to take Egypt out of the Israelites.
I love that.
Great wisdom there.
You know, I don't often agree with Friedrich Nietzsche, although I admire his courage, but his idea of a long obedience in the same direction, that's actually a good description of freedom and a good description of discipleship.
Yes.
So, as you know, I'm an evangelical, and many evangelicals have made the great mistake of putting all their eggs in the basket of conversion. You think of the born-again movement. But they didn't stress discipleship, and that's why much of the born-again movement didn't amount to very much. It was liberation without the ongoing task of liberty, which is the long obedience in the same direction.
Question five is, how do you plan to sustain freedom? And you write about this. Why should we be concerned about the last presidential election in 2016 and what has happened politically since then?
Well, I wrote in the earlier book, you know, people, the three tasks of establishing a free society, winning freedom, that's the revolution. Ordering freedom, giving it a moral, political framework, that was the Constitution. And the genius of America was that they did that, whereas the French, the Russians, and the Chinese didn't do it. And their revolutions spiraled down to demonic disorder. But the framers understood you couldn't just win it, order it, you had to sustain it. As Ben Franklin put it, a republic, madam, if you can keep it. Now that, of course, is the work of not just a few years, but centuries. In other words, that's our work today. And yet many Americans just take freedom for granted, and they don't think how freedom needs and can be sustained. Now the framers didn't give a word for their system. Tocqueville calls it the habits of the heart. I call it the golden triangle of freedom. You know, the freedom requires virtue. Virtue requires faith of some sort, and faith of any sort requires freedom, which requires virtue. And like the recycling triangle, it goes round and round and round. But most Americans today just couldn't be bothered with anything like that, and they think that freedom will just sustain itself. Well, the fact is, historically, we know it won't. So that question, how do you sustain freedom, has become urgent again. And those who don't like the framers' system better be very careful to put something better in its place. But at the moment, they throw out the framers' system and then don't bother with anything better.
And to amplify on the triangle of freedom, you write, in short, sustainable freedom depends on the character of the rulers and ruled alike, and on the vital trust between them, both of which are far more than a matter of law. The Constitution, that is the foundational law of the land, should be supported and sustained by faith, character, and the virtue of the entire citizenry, which comprises its moral constitution or habits of the heart. Freedom requires limited government, but limited government requires unlimited character in its citizens, as you just referred to, the habits of the heart. What does virtue have to do with freedom?
Well, that's all to do with the first leg of the triangle. Freedom requires virtue. Now, of course, for the framers, virtue is the classical word. It covered everything: honesty, loyalty, patriotism, integrity, and of course, it includes character. And so you see the difference to it. That's been thrown out. Take, say, the Clinton impeachment. There was a famous letter to the New York Times by certain scholars that said, character is irrelevant in the modern president. What matters is competence, not character. And you can see that today, truth, virtue, honesty, loyalty, who cares? It's what you can get away with. But that actually undermines freedom. Was it Franklin or Adams who said only a virtuous people are capable of freedom? And that's one of the places where the modern world is dead set against the understanding of the framers, and incidentally, the understanding of the Bible and of most of the classical understanding.
And so you write, the reason for the need for virtue is simple and incontrovertible. Only virtue can supply the self-restraint that is the indispensable requirement for liberty. Unrestrained freedom undermines freedom, but any other form of restraint on freedom eventually becomes a contradiction of freedom. And then second, the founders went beyond broad general statements on the importance of virtue to quite specific applications, such as the need to integrate virtue in both private and public life. And so character, you point out, character and virtue are often dismissed as private issues. The character was a purely private issue. What mattered in public was competence, not character. But character is...
Well, you know, one answer to that would be to look at, say, the history of the American presidency.
Yes.
Almost always, at the end of the day, character counts. You take very obvious examples like President Nixon. He was quite extraordinary in foreign policy and many other things, but he was brought down by his character. And you could say that many of those in his administration, you look at Bob Haldeman, Henry Kissinger, and many others, the weakness of what they did, despite their brilliance in many areas, was through their character. And the presidency alone gives you that argument very strongly.
And to complete it, the virtue requires faith, and faith requires freedom. Whether we had more time, let me just whet people's appetite. Sixth question, how will you make the world safe for diversity? Tell us a little bit about the sea change that has taken place on religious freedom in America.
Well, if you have a country that's diverse, you have to have freedom of conscience for everybody for there to be real peace and stability. And no country's done a better job than America over 300 years. And we've got to say that the idea that people came here and they fought the revolution for what the framers called civil and religious liberty would have been the consensus down in history. But sadly, the climax was in the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993. And since then, particularly in the Obama presidency, there's been a bigger sea change over freedom of religion and conscience than the previous 300 years. And I point to what I call the three dark R's, those who are reducers, who reduced religious freedom to freedom of worship, those who are the removers, who said, well, religion and public life, think of 9/11, what a dangerous business. Freedom of religion should be freedom from religion.
Yes.
But the third one is the most important of all, the rebranders, those who've taken what the founders in many sense would have called the first liberty, and they make it today a code word for discrimination, for bigotry, for hatred. Now, that's incredibly dangerous and incredibly illiberal, because it also undermines the right to dissent, the right to conscientious moral objection, and civil obedience. So this change, which is happening right now, is enormously important.
Why do you believe that humanity is at stake?
Well, because freedom and freedom of conscience is at the very heart of humanity. So there are two types of assaults on freedom. One is reductionism. Those who've reduced humanity to something determined by our genes, by our biology, by history, by economics, or whatever it is. And you can think almost all the great atheists from Marx and Spinoza right down to today are actually determinists. They don't believe in freedom. So you have the reductionists. But the others are the authoritarians. Take, say, a country supremely like China today. They do not believe in freedom. We do. Freedom is at the heart of humanity. But the fact is, you can't find a strong view of freedom outside of the Jewish and the Christian scriptures, the Bible. And that is the strongest grounding of freedom, and you can't find it elsewhere.
Let me read us out to our next break. You write again in your book, the title of the book is Last Call for Liberty. Each human has a measureless worth that goes beyond any possible descriptions of status, function, and utility. All other descriptions are vulnerable to our being reduced to our functions and utilitarian qualities. We are merely voters or viewers or buyers or consumers or passengers or statistics and so on. But made in the image of God, we each possess an equal and inalienable worth that is prior to every other category and consideration. This dignity and worth is therefore inalienable and inviolable. And you write, let the truth ring out throughout the world. Freedom of religion and conscience is not a code word for bigotry or prejudice. It stands as a sure and essential protection of human dignity and freedom. And so part of the difficulty is that disagreement is often now viewed as discrimination. And you write, there is more extremism in American culture warring than many acknowledge. And this extremism is on both sides. And so you're not taking one side or the other, but showing that we're all responsible for this in some way. Let's take this final break. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify with Dr. Os Guinness, talking about his book, Last Call for Liberty. Liberty. Os, is that storm coming to hit you in Virginia?
Yes.
Yes?
It hasn't come here, fortunately.
Okay. I hope it passes by you somehow. The seventh question is, how do you justify your vision of a free and open society? And you begin by saying the real winner in the U.S. election of 2016 was not Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, the Republicans or the Democrats, but China, Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, countries with an open disdain for freedom and democracy. The American Republic no longer seemed to be working. Americans tore at each other's throats and competed with each other in seeing how far anyone could go in challenging the legitimacy of those they disagreed with. And then you offer seven considerations on how to proceed and reflect on why we don't have constructive leadership that we need on the issue of religion and public life. And you point out that there can be no truce between 1776 and 1789, the clash of freedoms has to be settled in favor of one way or another, for they lead in entirely different directions. And that's really where we began our program. Question eight is, where do you ground your faith in human freedom? Tell us a little bit about this. You talk about the search for the meaning of life is perhaps the only meaning there is to life.
Well, as with many issues, you can look at the worldviews of today and really divide them into the three major families of worldviews or faiths and religions. You've got the Eastern, Buddhism, Hinduism, the New Age movements. You've got the secularist family, atheists, agnostics, materialists, naturalists. And you've got, of course, the Abrahamic family, which comprises more than half of humanity, Judaism, the Christian faith, and Islam. And I would argue strongly, you cannot ground freedom, as Americans have understood it, in either the Eastern family or the secularist family. And just before the break, we talked about the dignity of humanity. We're moving not just into a post-truth world, as it's often put. We're moving, sadly, into a post-rights world. Now, tomorrow will be the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But the Genesis Declaration that humans are made in the image of God, Rabbi Sacks called that the Magna Carta of humanity. And if you think there's nothing in our modern world that gives you a grounding for the inestimable, inalienable value of an individual. They can be badly handicapped, uneducated, desperately poor, but in the biblical understanding, they are made in the image and likeness of God. They are precious.
Yes.
You think of everything in our modern world. Say, utilitarianism, the greatest good of the greatest number. Or you take algorithms. Algorithms couldn't give a damn for the individual. It's all statistics. And you go on down the line. Only in the Bible, in the Jewish and Christian scriptures, you have the grounding of freedom and the grounding of human dignity. And that's absolutely magnificent. And all of us who are Christians should be champions and guardians and proud advocates of the biblical view of freedom and human dignity.
And so you raise the question, can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God? We seem to be drawing farther and farther away from that. It's almost as if, though, there's this growing number of people who are giving in to the influence of, how do I say it, evil, the evil one. I don't know how else to say it from my perspective.
No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. What you quoted was actually Thomas Jefferson, not me, but I would agree
okay,
with it strongly.
Well, oh, good.
And I would agree with it very strongly. And sadly, you know, I used to know Malcolm Muggeridge, the great British journalist
of
the last century. He used to say again, not a Catholic that you would love, he would say again and again, many of our liberals, without realizing it, are cutting off the branch on which they're sitting. And that's the sad thing. They think they're progressive and they're liberal, but actually they're undermining the very things that make progressives positive and makes liberals really free. And that's incredibly sad. Whereas it's those of us who are Christians who really are standing for freedom, standing for human dignity, and we're grateful and proud and glad to be doing so.
And you point out that you reflect in much of what is best about America is simply taken for granted. Too many Americans are repeating unexamined cliches and platitudes. Too many are mouthing claims they can no longer justify. And too many are putting their confidence in fashionable ideas whose consequences they have not examined. Question 9, are you vigilant about the institutions crucial to freedom? And one of the ones you raise is about that I've seen discussed on various talk shows is the potential dictatorship of the judiciary. Say a little bit about that.
Well, the one that actually concerns me most is the one of education and democracy, because, you know, the framers rejected direct democracy, and they chose the English-style representative democracy. But the 19th century was very aware that if you expand the suffrage, more and more people are able to vote, you have to also expand education so the people are able to vote, are wise enough to vote well and choose good leaders. But you can see that we've expanded universal education, and it's become mediocre, and civic education has dropped out. And the question is, can Americans today, when there's 330 million of them, really choose wisely and well? Well, you have things like referenda, take California. That's closer to direct democracy than to representative. Or you have Facebook's likes, and people more and more responding according to their feelings of the moment. And that's incredibly dangerous, because you're almost back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. What I feel is good is good. Mm-hmm. And what I feel is bad is bad. Well, that's absolute nonsense. And many of the reasons people are voting today and making their opinions known today are really very dangerously emotional and irrational. And so you're undermining the very possibility of a wise republic and a wise democracy.
You express other concerns of when you ask what would happen if a sufficient number of Americans no longer believe that anything close to Lincoln's definition of democracy still operated. what would happen if a sufficient number of Americans reached the point at which they wanted strong government rather than self-government and saw the two as mutually exclusive, and then reached out for a strong man to carry out their will and put things right. And a little bit further than you reflect, it was the Bible and its teaching about covenant, human dignity, human freedom, and human responsibility that made it possible to achieve, quote, government of the people, by the people, for the people, close quote. It is a question, you write, it is questionable whether democracy will survive the primacy of inner feelings, and it is a certainty that it will not if the wider truths of the Bible continue to be repudiated decisively. That's a very strong concern.
Well, you know, I think that is my concern, and of course, you can't argue that today. You have to wait to see what history shows and the future will bring. But I think we're building up a harvest of social chaos, psychological confusion, and economic consequences that come from some of the extreme movements that are being pushed forward today. So I would stand by that, and I'd be happy to say, let's come back in 20 years' time and see where things are. And if they go the present way, it will be towards decline and disaster. But it needn't go that way.
And in each chapter, with each question of the 10 questions, you transition at the end into the next question, the next chapter. And in this one, you write, what must also never be forgotten is a relationship between democracy and republican liberty. For the founders and all who love freedom, republican liberty is the goal, and democracy is the only means. To mistake the means for the goal is to put the cart before the horse, and to keep on doing it stubbornly is to pronounce a death sentence on freedom and the republic, likes or no likes. And that leads then to question 10, are you vigilant about the ideas crucial to freedom? Tell us about the present and possible future influence as you see it of the internet on this process.
Well, the internet and social media, on the one hand, they make it harder for any of us to really understand well what's going on. Not just fake news, but the overwhelming amount of information and so on. But also they open the possibility for manipulation and distortion and propaganda. So they add an element that makes democracy even harder. But the last chapter is even more crucial for me because you can see that most of the ideas, political correctness, postmodernism, multiculturalism, identity politics, social constructionism, I'm rolling these terms off the tongue, you know, supremely the sexual revolution.
Yes.
Every one of those goes back to 1789, the French Revolution, and its ideas of freedom, not to the American Revolution. And yet they are now predominant in the elite universities and the intelligentsia of our country. And that's extremely dangerous. If they continue to win, America's finished as a republic as you were set up to be. So that last chapter is in many ways one of the most important.
Right. You write, for those who follow the way of 1776 and the very different truths of grace and forgiveness that lie behind it, genuine wrongs can lead to genuine repentance and then to genuine forgiveness and the possibility of a genuine second chance in life and restoration in the community. And there's that hope that with which you write. But once again, you ask, will it be said that freedom was too hard a challenge for Americans to overcome? Quite simply, you write, the decisions Americans make in the next generation will shape the course of American freedom and decide the fate of the American Republic. And there's so much that you say in each of these questions. I hope people understand we are really glossing over them in the time that's available to us. And then in your conclusion, you talk about America's choice, covenant, chaos, or control. What is it that you want to close with in your book?
Well, the choice is here. I call this the Rubicon moment. You remember when Julius Caesar, you know, coming back from Gaul where he was the consul, questioned should he cross the river, the Rubicon, or not. If he crossed, he was taking on the Republic and challenging them. Eventually, after a lot of thought, he crossed the Rubicon. And from then onwards, as Cicero said, Rome, the Republican Rome, was a republic in name only, a rhino. That was the first use of the term in history, not Republican in name only, but Republic in name only. And in the same way, these ideas which come from the liberal left from 1789, if they triumph completely, and they could, for example, say there's a massive reaction to President Trump and a swing even further towards the left, that could be the end. I mean, there's all sorts of potential scenarios. But we're at that Rubicon moment, and Americans need to really think, what is the republic that we want? What is the state of the union over freedom? What are our choices today? What will be the consequences of those choices? And hopefully, there'll be enough who believe in a restoration, a renewal of the covenant, a renewal of the American republic, so that this great experiment in freedom will go forward to greater days. That's my hope and prayer. But things aren't looking well at the moment.
And so there is a hopeful possibility, right? The recovenanting of America, or the renewal of the American covenant of freedom, which could lead to a genuine new birth of freedom and justice. Without a renewal of the American ideas and ideals, America will never become great again, however prodigious the effort. As with other covenantal societies, you write, the truth is that the United States goes forward best by going back first. It must return to its roots in constitutional or covenantal freedom, renewing the ideals that made it possible and righting the wrongs where America has betrayed its founding promise. By recovenanting and going back first, the United States is in fact able to go forward. I guess this evening has been Dr. Os Guinness, and the title of the book is Last Call for Liberty, How America's Genius for Freedom Has Become Its Greatest Threat. Os, thank you so very much for being with us, and I hope that you and all your loved ones have a very blessed Christmas.
And the same to you. Thanks for having me again. I always enjoy it.
Thank you. I certainly, I learned so much. All right.
Thank you, Father.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
One of my favorite, of course, guests that I really love having on the program. He ends up by asking, "Choose then, America, whether you wish to stay true to the better angels of your founding promise and shoulder the burden of being the world's beacon of responsible and enduring freedom." Choose whether you desire life or death, blessings or curses, freedom and flourishing, or chaos and decline. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.